Hello and welcome to our food principles module. And it's all about low carb and ultra low carb diets today. We're going to look at the Atkins diet, the South Beach diet, the Zone diet, Paleo diet, and various forms of ketogenic diets. So I'm excited to present this because there's so much talk about these kinds of diets and there's a lot of controversy about these kinds of diets, and there are some good things and not so good things about these kinds of diet. And what does it all boil down to? Again, as we talk about all the time, biochemical individuality. Some people do phenomenally well on these types of diets. Some people crash and burn big time. And the good news is you don't have to throw the whole diet away if it doesn't seem to work for someone. You can actually modify it to make it work for that person's individual needs. So before we begin, everything that I teach is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's not medical advice. And when you teach this sort of stuff to your clients, just make sure that you're in a position of sharing that this is not medical advice, this is information, and you're there to support them and educate them and help them to work with their doctor to make a decision. Now, if they're not under the care of a doctor, that's a different story, but you still are not giving them medical advice. And if they are on any medications or under the care of a doctor, the stuff that we do can shift physiology and biochemistry rather quickly. And you've got to talk to them about checking in with their doctor if they're on medication, because the need for those medications can shift dramatically. So that all said, we're going to look at these low-carb diets. So Mr. Carnivore is saying, I'd like a quadruple bacon cheeseburger with extra bacon. Hold the bread. I'm on a diet. And we see that a lot, don't we? We see people who are bypassing the vegetables because they're counting their carbs and the vegetables have too many carbs, but they're sitting there eating their bacon cheeseburger and without the bun, of course. There was another slide I wanted to incorporate here, but it had a copyright on it. It said, don't use this without permission, but it's very cute. It had a snorkeler at the top floating along on the water and two sharks looking up there. And one was holding the Atkins diet book and reading and looking up at the guy swimming along. He goes, as far as I can tell, as long as we don't eat the buns, we're good to go. And I just thought that was so cute. And it's so reflective of this kind of diet. So, and there's a lot of misconceptions about what low carb and ketogenic and paleo diets are. So we'll hope to clarify that. Now, this is not intended to be a complete discourse on each of these diets, because we could be here for quite a number of days with that, given that there's an individual book on each one. But we're going to synopsize for you what the basic components, constituents, allowed food, disallowed food, the goals, the benefits, and the downsides. So let's just jump right in and begin. So I want to make sure that we're really clear that low carb diets are not the same as carb restrictive diets. And we've talked about those in other presentations. Carb restrictive diets, meaning they're not low carb, but they are restrictive of the kinds of carbs that can be included. And those include the SCD, the specific carbohydrate diet, the GAPS, the gut and psychology diet, the FODMAPs, fermentable oligodimonosaccharides and polyols. And those are all diets that are usually done for gut health. And some of the versions of the paleo are not necessarily low carb. The ones that are more low carb, and we'll talk more about those today, Atkins, Zone, the South Beach, sort of, the ketogenic, and others, and most forms of the, or many forms of the paleo diet. So let's talk low-carb diets. Low-carb diets restrict net carbs. So what are net carbs? Net carbs are the total number of carbs minus the total number of fiber grams. So for example, if we're talking, I don't know, let's just say it's some sort of low-starchy vegetable, non-starchy vegetable, it may have a total of 17 grams of carb, and 15 of those are fiber. Cellulose, right? So those don't count as carb because those aren't absorbed. Those are just used to sweep things through. So that food would have a net carb intake of 2. And I think that's where a lot of people get confused, and they eliminate a lot of the non-starchy vegetables from their low-carb diets as opposed to filling up on them because they're concerned about the carb, when in reality, the number of carbs is mostly fiber when we're talking about our non-starchy, low-starchy vegetables. So carbs are restricted to a certain number of grams or a certain percentage, and we'll look at different diets that restrict it in different ways. These low-carb diets are certainly helpful in controlling blood sugar. The Sweet Spot Solution diet that I've put out is a low-carb diet. It's a low-carb diet to the extent that the person needs it to be a low-carb diet in terms of controlling their blood sugar. For some people, it's much lower carb and verging on a ketogenic diet, and for some people, it's a higher, more moderate carb diet. Can sometimes reduce inflammation and edema. Often they can reduce inflammation and edema, but the kinds of diets that some of these are, where they don't restrict some of the inflammatory foods, are not necessarily going to reduce inflammation and edema, and I'll show you what those are. They can definitely help with yeast and fungal and bacterial overgrowth. We stop feeding the bad critters in the gut because they like carbs, they like sugars, they like starches, and that can really help to thwart those overgrowths. Some of the plans don't restrict the types of carbs. So some of them use a lot of processed foods. They'll have bacon, they'll have cheese, they'll have cheese food, they'll have various kinds of fake cereals that are carb-free. They'll use a lot of the Franken foods, as I like to call them, the fake foods. And they don't restrict that. They don't restrict the quality of the foods. They just restrict the quantity of the carbs. And obviously those are the ones we're not going to be wanting to promote too well. Many of them promote too much meat, too many animal fats, and too much dairy. And we know a lot of people are allergic to dairy. We know that the lactose in the dairy can contribute to estrogen-sensitive cancers and other things. We know that dairy can clog up the intestinal tract with its casein and can cause lactose intolerance and diarrhea and all that. Excess meat, a lot of arachidonic acid, excess animal fats, a lot of arachidonic acid. And if it's quality, if it's not a quality meat where it's grown out, you know, without chemicals, without hormones and pasture raised versus the commercial meat, huge difference. So many of them, most of these diets don't actually make a distinction between the quality of the food. Many of them use sugar alcohols, which are fine for a majority of people, but a lot of people who have FODMAP sensitivities, who have irritable bowel, may not do well there, even though those are sugar alcohols are not really carbs because they're not processed the same way. They can still have a negative impact on the gut. And some of them may include a carb refeed kind of binge eat where, you know, you do this diet for 3 weeks and then you can take 3 days and just eat whatever you want. Some of them do that a couple of times a week and they're the off and on type diets. And that's not necessarily the best thing, especially when we're trying to help people with their emotional eating and their control of their eating and the quality of their food, quite frankly. So just as a review, the four types of carbohydrates, monosaccharides, disaccharides, oligosaccharides, polysaccharides, as we've seen in our presentations on the specific carbohydrate diet, the FODMAPs diet, the GAPS diet, it's important the type of carbohydrate that's eaten. In these low-carb diets, they don't necessarily make a distinction between those. So we have the monosaccharides, glucose, fructose, galactose. We've got the disaccharides, sucrose, lactose, maltose. We've got oligosaccharides, which are a longer chain, anywhere from 3 to 10 saccharides strung together. And we've got, of course, our polysaccharides, which are many, which are our starches and cellulose, the fibers, the mucilagins, the pectins, the dextrose, etc. They require special enzymes to break the bonds between those, whereas the oligosaccharides are longer, but we don't as humans actually have those bonds to break them apart. So the oligosaccharides become food for the flora, and those would be things like fructooligosaccharides and things like that. And then the simple versus complex. And I think this is a major distinction because if we're talking a low-carb diet that says, okay, you're allowed to have below 50 grams of carbohydrates in your day, or you need to keep your carbohydrate to 20% of your total caloric intake, it makes a huge difference what people are taking in. And I'm really about the quality of the food that we're helping people to take in, as well as the macronutrient, the percentages and the quantity. So really be careful about watching what people are doing. Oh, I'm on a low carb diet, and you see that the the carbs they're eating, yeah, then maybe they're on a 10 to 20% carb diet, but the carbs they're eating are just not good for them, type of starches and things like that. So let's talk about ketosis a little bit, and we'll talk more about that towards the end. The last diet we're going to talk about today is the ketogenic diet. But low carb diets tend to push people into a phase towards ketones, burning ketones. And there's a distinction between ketosis and ketoacidosis. So a lot of people freak out by the word ketosis because they're thinking ketoacidosis, which happens in type 1 diabetes a lot, where they just are building up the acidic byproducts, and they're actually, their blood pH starts to go acidic, and that's a dangerous and can be deadly situation. Ketosis is just the shifting of the body from its primary fuel being glucose to its primary fuel being ketones. And we'll be looking at exactly what ketone bodies are, but it's basically they're derived from fat. So the ketones that we can burn are either ketones in the food that we're eating or ketones that are derived from our own body fat as it gets released. And a third is exogenous ketones, which can be taken in. And we'll go through all those distinctions as we go through. The ketosis effect begins when the insulin levels get low. And insulin is at its lowest when, guess what? Blood glucose levels are low. At the exception of a person who's either type 1 diabetic or a type 2 diabetic who's worn out their pancreas, in which case they may have high blood sugar but low insulin. So for the majority of folks who end up being insulin resistant or type 2 diabetic or just pre-insulin resistant, insulin gets low when the glucose levels are low. So when insulin levels get low, it induces fat burning, right? We can't burn fat when insulin levels are high. We know that. So lipolysis, the breakdown of stored fat, is triggered when the insulin levels go low. The insulin levels are going to go low with a sustained low carbohydrate intake that keeps the blood sugar low. Okay, so the lipolysis consumes our body fat. It can also consume the breakdown of fats that are taken in, but it basically breaks them down to produce ketone bodies. Low-carb diets can be helpful for gut healing. Why? Because they starve the bacteria. They remove the diet polysaccharides and the monosaccharides that can feed the bacteria. And so the bacteria tend to starve, especially if you combine a low-carb diet with some gut healing nutrients and some antimicrobial natural things, you know, teas and herbs and other things like that. It can certainly relieve the symptoms of dysbiosis, right? The symptoms of dysbiosis usually mean gas and bloating and discomfort, pain, and irritable bowel, which can be inflammation and doubling over and spasm in the intestines. And it encourages gut healing by rebalancing the gut microbiota. Remember, you can go put somebody on a gut healing protocol, but if you don't address underlying microbes, if they're there, the gut healing protocol isn't going to work. So they have to be taken on either sequentially or concurrently. And we go through all those details in the digestion part of the program, Digestive Mastery. So let's talk about the metabolic effects of a low-carb diet. Well, they generally result in reduced blood sugar levels. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes people decrease their carbs and their sugars don't necessarily go down, and there may be other metabolic problems there. But the majority of time, low-carb diets result in reduced blood sugar, which helps to reverse insulin resistance. It helps to reduce the amount of insulin that's then secreted, and then that helps the insulin receptors to repair. The shift from using fat, ketones as fuel, or to using fat, the ketones as fuel, can improve brain function. And low-carb diets and ketogenic diets are actually used a lot in trying to heal people who have brain dysfunction, like seizures, like Alzheimer's, memory dysfunction, neurodegeneration of the brain, ADD. These diets have been found to be very, very helpful for people there. It can be very helpful for helping release excess weight because it triggers the burning of stored fat, right? If somebody goes into this fat burning mode, and as long as they're not eating a ton of fat, their fat they're going to burn is, guess where? On their bottom, in their waist. wherever they have stored excess fat. The level of carbs needs to be adjusted according to the person. So you might read a book and it says, make sure that you get less than 100 grams of carbs a day or less than 50 grams of carb a day. Now, how could we think that that recommendation would be the same for a 105-pound little petite woman and a 220-pound bodybuilder? It's very different. It has to do with their size, their age, their lifestyle, their activities. Right, so we're going to look at the different diets and we're going to see what they recommend and talk about the pros and the cons. The Atkins diet is one of the oldest ones. It's promoted by Dr. Robert Atkins, who's deceased now. It was based on a paper in 1958 in the Journal of the American Medical Association called Weight Reduction by Alfred W. Pennington. It became popular when Atkins wrote his book, 2003 to 2004, and it began this low-carb craze, the fad diet, very fad diet, because what happened is when people started doing the Atkins diet, they just started like eating bacon and cheese and all kinds of heavy cream and all these heavy-duty fatty foods, especially heavy on the dairy and meat. And they weren't paying any attention to micronutrients. They weren't paying any attention to getting their veggies in. They were looking at it as, oh, we have to restrict the veggies. Oh, I'm only allowed to have two leaves of lettuce because otherwise I'm going to get too much carb. So that was the early iterations of it. And I know a lot of people who had a lot of problems. They lost weight dramatically going on this diet for a couple of weeks. And then they started to develop all sorts of micronutrient imbalances and kidney problems and things like that, electrolyte imbalances, weakness, passing out. So it really works on a short-term versus a long-term weight reduction, actually, because it just causes a breakdown really quickly, and then there's an adaptation period. Because I believe in this particular diet, there's a missing link with micronutrients. He sells his own foods, and the foods, if you look at them, are not anything that you or I would want to recommend to our clients. It's not real food. He actually died at the age of 72 in 2003, and there was a controversy. His proponents said, yeah, he fell, he hit his head, he had a hematoma, and he died. Others say he had a heart attack, and he had a history of heart disease, and others blamed the diet on his heart attack because he was scoffing down steaks and bacon and cheese and cheeseburgers and all this sort of stuff. We don't know the actual truth. The Atkins diet, here's the classic approach. Phase one, it's called the Atkins 20. Phase one says 20 to 25 grams of net carbs daily for 2 weeks. So that's phase one. Phase two is 25 to 50 grams of net carbs daily. So you're within 10 pounds of your goal weight. And at that point, you can increase it to 50 to 80 grams of net carbs daily until the goal is reached and maintained for a month. And then for maintenance, you do 80 to 100 grams. So that's the Atkins 20 approach, the classic Atkins approach. So he modified this if you have less than 40 pounds to lose or pregnant or have special health issues, probably because of some issues that were happening because of the lack of micronutrient balance. So it starts with 40 grams of net carbs daily, 10 grams at each of three meals, and 2 5-gram snacks. He's big on having snacks. Whee, ouch. When 10 pounds from goal weight, you can add 10 grams of net carbs per week. Okay, so with this diet, number one, yeah, he's promoting snacks, which several of these low-carb diets are. And then he's promoting eating every 2 to 3 hours so that you're never hungry. Well, what do we know happens when we eat every 2 to 3 hours? We're kind of defeating some of the purpose of this low-carb diet is that we're always having insulin in the system, especially since it's not a severe low-carb. When you get into the 50 to 80, 80 to 100, we're in mode where we've got a lot of insulin coursing it. I don't think that's a great deal. And they claim that you don't need to exercise, which maybe you don't need to exercise to lose weight, but you sure do need to exercise for overall health and oxygenation and brain health and heart health and all that. So that's the Atkins diet. So the way that they look at it is protein, they're taking 3 servings a day, 4 to 6 ounces a serving, and they're looking at animal food. So what does that say? 4 to 6 ounces a serving. Let's just say at the max end, we're looking at 18 ounces of meat a day versus 12 ounces. So 12 to 18 ounces of meat a day is a lot of meat. Very acidifying to the system, a lot of nitrogenous waste, a lot of arachidonic acid. So that those numbers definitely concern me. And he doesn't say that it needs to be lean or it needs to be organic or pastured or anything like that. And then fats are, you're allowed 3 servings per day of added fats. And a serving of fat is typically considered a tablespoon. But again, it doesn't matter what. It could be mayonnaise, it could be butter, it could be any kind of oil, salad dressings that have all kinds of other garbage in them. No distinction with quality here. So some examples of what somebody might be eating on phase one is they'll have leafy greens and low-carb vegetables. Yay! But not very much because they have to watch their carbs. Beef, poultry, seafood, pork, eggs, packaged meat. They're allowed bacon, sausage, deli meats. They're asked to, whenever possible, to avoid the fillers and sugar and MSG and sulfites and nitrates. Well, that's good, but sour cream, most hard cheeses, butter, salad dressings, and mayonnaise. I mean, we know mayonnaise is hydrogenated fat. It's one of the worst things, especially for people with inflammation. And obese people generally tend to be obese. I mean, to have inflammation. Olive, canola, grapeseed, coconut, flaxseed, safflower oil. So they don't make a distinction between the quality of the oils, cold pressed, etc. So they're really not really helping their eicosanoid pathways, as another diet we're going to look at focuses on in a bit. So the foods they're supposed to avoid are all chestnuts or high carb nuts. I don't know which those are, but chestnuts certainly are a high carb nut. Watermelon and high carb fruits, starchy vegetables, fruit juices, dried fruit, white flour, sugar, refined carbs, alcohol, personal trigger foods that cause cravings. So that's good. They're asked to avoid some of those things that they shouldn't be eating. They're allowed nuts and seeds, but not chestnuts. They're allowed berries, cherries, and melons, but not watermelon. Whole milk, yogurt, fresh cheeses, cottage cheese, ricotta cheese, legumes, including chickpeas and lentils. Those are fairly high carbs, so you're not going to get away with a lot of those given the restrictions on the number of carbs. Tomato and vegetable juice cocktails, other fruits, but not fruit juices or dried fruits. So it's got some good components here. Higher carb vegetables are not allowed, winter squash, carrots, peas, etc., and alcohol in moderation. Well, alcohol is a pretty darn high carb food, right? I don't know why you'd even allow it in moderation, because it's just like pure sugar. It goes to the cells quicker than sugar and raises insulin levels pretty quickly. But that's the way it goes. So let's take a little switch to another diet called the South Beach Diet. It's a later iteration of similar to the Atkins, but it's actually a little bit better. He developed a cardiologist, Dr. Arthur Agatston from Miami, Miami Beach, developed it for his heart patients. And he followed the AMA's low-fat, high-carb, he was finding that the AMA's low-fat, high-carb diet just wasn't working for his patients in terms of lowering their cholesterol, lowering their weight, and lowering their blood sugar. But they were trying the Atkins diet and it was working. So he tried to improve upon the Atkins diet. He removed the saturated fats and added more lean protein and fiber. And he originally called it the modified carbohydrate diet. His idea was the right fats, the right carbs versus low fats, low carbs. And he did focus on the glycemic impact of the foods. That was back in April 2003 when he released the South Beach Diet book. So let's take a look at that in a little bit more detail. This one doesn't limit the carbs to a specific number of grams per day. Instead, it focuses on percentages. So the CDC recommends 40 to 65% of calories from carbs. That's about 225 to 325 carbs grams per 2,000 calories. Well, if we look at the South Beach diet in phase one, they're looking at less than 10% of calories from carbs, which is about 50 grams of carbs daily for a 2,000 calorie diet. In phase two, they go up to 25% in carbs, which is about 135 grams of carbs. So we're getting up there in the amount of carbs for 2,000 calories. And then in phase three, up to 30%, which is about 140 grams of carbs. This is not a ketogenic diet, as we're going to see. This is not a diet that is going to enhance ketosis or allow people to burn a lot of ketones, except maybe in the phase one where they're going at 50 grams or less. There's still a fair amount of carbs. And again, that most of these diets, they created their own line of processed foods and snacks. So here's what he allows. So he calls the protein is lean beef, lean poultry, not the fatty portions of it, not, you know, the heavily marbled stuff. Seafood, eggs, dairy, again, no or low fat, and cheese, low fat in terms of cottage cheese. So he's really focusing on keeping the fats down and just having good fats. So what he considers good fats are canola oil. I would tend to argue with that one. Extra virgin olive oil, avocado nuts, monounsaturated fats, and that's like avocados and things like that, and omega-3 fats. So he is focusing on get the fats from good stuff and leave out the trans fats. So he wouldn't have mayonnaise on his diet. The saturated fats, butter, animal fats, you know, except for the amount that's in lean protein, and then partially hydrogenated. So overall, it seems to be a huge improvement over the Atkins. We're not going to be eating bacon and hard cheeses and all the other things. So the things that he says to avoid are what that list of bad fats. In phase one, they're avoiding all starchy vegetables. And in all the phases, the fruit juices, the dried fruits, the white flour, sugar, refined carbs, alcohol. Great. And now the new phase one is gluten-free. Cool. So personal trigger foods that caused cravings, and all of them do that. So this is a big improvement over what people are eating, right? A big improvement over the standard American diet. Plus, they're really watching the quality of the fats. So the South Beach diet seems to be a little bit more balanced, let's just say, than the Atkins diet. And then along came the Zone Diet. These all came out sort of around the same time. The Zone Diet was released in 1999. So he was focused, Barry Sears was focused on weight loss, and he was also focused on inflammation. So he came up with the ratio of a meal as 30% protein, 40% carbs, and 30% fat. So his is much higher in carb, still a lot lower in carb than the standard diet that people have, but very much more much higher than the others. So you're not going to get into ketosis on the Zone Diet. There, his goal was to keep insulin and glucagon ratio just right for fat burning. So not too much insulin, and to trigger the glucagon whenever needed. But he's again having people eat five times a day, no more than 5 hours between meals. We're telling people more to eat minimum 5 hours between meals, and to eat 2 to 3 times a day. And that's very different from the ketogenic diet as well, which is more in line with what I like to see. He says he uses the size of the hand, because when this diet came out, it's like, how do I know what 30% protein is? So you use your fist to measure your food. So two big fists is a portion of good carbs. One big fist is a portion of bad carbs. Zone blocks and mini blocks are used to measure ratios easily. So if you have good carbs, you get two fists, and bad carbs are one fist. So what does it look like? So you have a defined macronutrient ratio each meal, like we said, 30 protein, 30 fat, and 40% carb. And the physiological state of the body can be measured. Like when you're in the zone, you're doing that, and your inflammation markers are low. Your triglyceride HDL ratio is less than 1. Your arachidonic acid EPA ratio is between 1.5 and 3. The average person has this at 10 or more. And when I see people, because I see people who are not doing so well, I'm seeing 15 and 20 and higher in their arachidonic acid EPA ratio. And we go into a lot more detail on what that means and the various ratios and recommendations in the fats module, in the macronutrients module. And yeah, that's an inflammatory marker. The triglyceride HDL, he was the one that started talking about that being a really good insulin resistance marker, and others have picked up on that as well. He likes to see hemoglobin A1C 5% or less. So that's kind of really restrictive compared to the standard blood levels. He also has his own line of processed foods and snacks. They all do. Three parts of the program: the Zone Plate, the omega-3 fatty acids, and polyphenol. So he's focused on getting some of those antioxidant-rich foods in to people. And this is what the Zone pyramid looks like. You can't argue with having vegetables at the base, fruits next, low-fat protein, monounsaturated fats, and then grains and starches way up at the top, which is the opposite of the standard American food pyramid. So huge improvement over the standard American diet, and I believe a huge improvement over the other two low-fat diets, although the South Beach is not bad either, but it seems to be very, very restricted on fats. So here's some examples of what person might eat on the zone diet, right? Protein's going to be a third of their plate. That's a lot of protein if you're talking animal fat. Lean protein, he's talking, you know, lean meats, fish, poultry, lean beef, that kind of thing, low-fat dairy and egg whites, but not egg yolks. So really focused on some of that fat, you know, the saturated fats and keeping those low. I think that, you know, that's quite a bit of protein if you're just counting animal protein, in my opinion. So the thing I think downside of this diet is that it's very high in animal protein, but it has some other good traits. A little bit of monounsaturated fat like olive oil, avocados, and almonds are recommended on this diet, but not much in the way of fat at all. And then the carbohydrates are two-thirds of the plate. Which is a lot of colorful vegetables with a little bit of fruit, and avoid things like bananas, carrots, grapes, and starchy vegetables like potatoes and corn. So it's a fairly balanced, you know, and if people are measuring their glucose and they tolerate that much carbohydrate, I'm all for it. I'm not for a specific low carbohydrate diet. I'm for the amount of carbohydrate that a person needs to be in balance, to find their sweet spot. So let's take a shift from the low-fat diets to what's paleo. And a paleo diet is not necessarily a low-fat diet, but it can, I mean, a low-carb diet, but it can be a low-carb diet, and it most always is. Some of the paleo variations will include dairy products, which are not low-carb. So based on the foods available to what Paleolithic era humans, what do we know about that? Well, we know that they did hunting and they did gathering, and we know that they didn't have access to meals on a regular basis, that they couldn't sit down and eat three meals a day. They ate when they found food, and they were not able to go to the grocery store if they ran out. If they ran out, they were hungry, and they learned to do that, and they learned to go inside and use the fuel that was stored. So there's a lot of interpretations of this diet. If you pick up a bunch of different paleo books, you're going to see a lot of different interpretations. You'll see a lot of paleo diets that don't even resemble anything like what people ate in the Paleolithic era. Like, people didn't eat paleo wraps. They didn't make coconut flour pancakes. They didn't make coconut flour cupcakes, right? They didn't eat a ton of eggs mixed in with a little bit of nut flour and make it into a dessert. They just didn't do that in the Paleolithic era. And I think of all the diets, a paleo diet, the modern paleo diet, can be one of the healthier diets with some modifications. I think what happens is that people focus on the paleo diet being having meat and animal fat and all this stuff at every meal. And a lot of them are really, really promoting things like lard and tallow, which is pure animal fat. Those aren't whole foods, my friends. Neither are oils. So there's a lot of variation we can make in these that create a diet that's whole foods. So as much as we think of sugar as not being a whole food, or white flour as not being a whole food, olive oil's not a whole food either. Butter's not a whole food. Those are not whole foods. They're fat extracted from a whole food, just the same way as the others are sugar extracted from a whole food. So we really want to keep in mind, as we're helping people with these diets, to avoid fads and to avoid things that smack in the face of nature. As much as possible, we want people to eat whole foods. Yes, there are times when somebody's completely depleted in certain things, and we want to give them a protein powder because their body is not handling protein from the whole foods. Protein powder is not a whole food either. So non-whole foods are not necessarily bad, but you've got to be thinking of them in terms of therapeutic use mostly, or a use for convenience sake, like, okay, we can't make it to, you know, the store to get whatever, we're going to have protein powder and green powder because we don't have any greens in the house. So we've got to really think in terms of getting people as close as possible to a whole food diet. 40% fat, that's kind of high, but that's not anywhere near as high as you're going to see when we do a ketogenic diet. And if it's all good whole fats, it could be just fine. Okay, so it's really a matter of figuring it out. A paleo diet doesn't have to be 40% protein at a meal. A paleo diet can be higher skewed towards fat, but not necessarily higher skewed towards carbs, although if we don't just count net carbs, we count total carbs and fiber, it'd be great for somebody sitting down to have a meal that has 35 grams of fiber. Great for their digestion and their health. So there's a lot of wide variation, so read the books and see, but figure out what works for your person. And it doesn't, I'm not a big fan of the ones that take a lot of animal fats and extract them out of foods and feed them to people. It can be very acid forming, right? Depending on how people eat. Now, I eat a version of a paleo diet, but I eat plant powered. So is it really a paleo diet? No, I just call it that because that sounds familiar to people. I avoid the things that the paleos tell people to eat. So some of the variations these days are people have come up with their own versions. Ancestral diet, hunter-gatherer, caveman diet, Neanderthal, primal diet, warrior diet, and they all have slightly different variations. And then there's the autoimmune paleo, which is super restrictive. Somebody came up with the idea that you need to get rid of everything practically and just eat vegetables and animal fat, and that will solve the problem of autoimmune because it solved it for that person. And it's gotten popularity, and it eliminates all the nuts and all the seeds and all the legumes and all the grains and the quinoa and all of that stuff. And it could, and egg, but it also excludes the eggs and definitely excludes the dairy. So there's people on an autoimmune paleo, is very little left for them to eat. For some people, it works really well. For other people, they don't have to be quite that strict and restrict some of the nuts and seeds. It just depends on what's going on. So the history of it, there was a book written in 1975 called The Stone Age Diet. And it was written by a gastroenterologist of all folks, Walter Voigtlin. And the reaction to the diseases of affluence was severe. He was like, everybody's getting all these problems because of the diseases of affluence, right? We have all this rich food. We have the availability of processed food, and that's not good. So this diet that he put out just avoids all the modern processed foods, which is what most paleo diets actually adhere to. But also avoids foods that came after the Neolithic Revolution, when humans transitioned from hunter-gatherer to settled agriculture. So they would include some root vegetables, but not grains, because those are considered Neolithic. It's after the time when we were hunter-gatherers and we were transitioning to agriculture. It was popularized in 2002 by a book by Lauren Cordain called The Paleo Diet. It's kind of interesting because all of these diets, these low-carb type B diets, seem to come out around the same time, point in time, late 90s, early 2000s. And it was interesting, if you look on Google, it's the most searched word, the paleo diet. It has gained in popularity. There are hundreds of books. There are hundreds of recipe guides, the paleo pancake book, the paleo dessert book. And a lot of it is just variations on a theme. Okay, you take these rules and then we try to apply modern stuff. Like pancakes was not a Paleolithic food. Muffins were not Paleolithic foods. So we're just kind of using these things and we call it paleo, but I just think they need a new name. So the general paleo foods, the allowed stuff, vegetables, roots, nuts, fruits, organ meats, meats, seafood, and eggs. Excluded are dairy, processed foods, grains, added sugar, legumes, processed oils, added salt, alcohol, and coffee. Now, you will be surprised when I go to conferences that there are lots of paleo practitioners there, and most of them drink coffee, but they drink bulletproof coffee, so they think that that's okay. And most of them just love their alcohol. They love their wine. So it's interesting to see what people are teaching versus what people are doing. And it's all a matter of finding what works for each of the people that you're working with. You pick a little bit of this, you pick a little bit of that. I had a t-shirt buried in my closet somewhere, and it's a quote from Gandhi that says, every religion has a piece of the truth. Every food religion, barring the standard American diet, has a piece of the truth. They do. And then it's a matter of finding what those pieces are that are true for you and true for your clients based on doing a full assessment of their needs. So that's it for the low carb diets. You've heard my, you know, my biases towards, in a way, I'm really for a low carb diet that includes a lot of veggies and excuse the processed foods. So in theory, the paleo diet rings a lot of truth for me. I just am very opposed to the high levels of meat and animal fat that people are eating. And when I watch when people eat, they are not filling their plate with 75% veggies and 25% meat. It actually goes the other way around. And if you can get somebody to choose the quality of their meat really carefully and only eat meat that's been raised organically without the pesticides, without the herbicides, without the injections, the hormones, and it was pastured, then that's fine. But again, I'm not a big fan of extracting the fat from the animals and thinking that that's a good food, or butter. You hear some people who are big paleo advocates saying things like, yeah, the vegetables are a good carrier for the butter. Like, really, what is butter revered as such an amazingly good food? It's a food. It's, you know, and we need to stop revering certain foods that are very much decadent foods that we tend to like. Bacon. Oh my God, bacon. People love bacon. But is bacon a healthy food? Is it a good food? It's a processed form of meat. If you're going to eat meat, just take a hunk of buffalo meat and put it on your plate and have it with a ton of veggies. That's a healthier version of that diet. So we're going to transition into ketogenic diets, and ketogenic diets are the most therapeutic of the diets. And we really use ketogenic diets very therapeutically, and there are very, very strong evidence that these things help so, so many people. But it's something you've got to be careful in working with people with, especially if you're working with a kid with epilepsy. In fact, it's a good idea for them to be working with somebody who's guided them through. And again, with a ketogenic diet, you can do a healthier version of a ketogenic diet and a not so healthy version of a ketogenic diet. So let's look at that. They are ultra low carb and high fat in general. The common macros for them are 70% fat, 10% carbs, 20% protein. The idea is to get the body to produce ketone bodies. Ketone bodies, beta hydroxybutyrate, acetate, these are things, acetone, these are things that the body can then burn as fuel instead of sugar. And we're going to look at the advantages of doing that. It could include a weekly or monthly carb refeed. So some people will do ketogenic for 5 days and then 2 days of higher carb, where they basically binge and then they go back, and that works for some. Some people get adapted over a long time to ketogenic and they need to do that carb refeed in order to regain the benefits. So it's a matter of figuring that out. There are a lot of good websites. I have a lot of references for ketogenic diets here that you can check out. Some of them advocate the use of caffeine and as a stimulant, just to keep the rev up the body. Caffeine is acidifying. So when we're talking about ketogenic ketosis versus ketoacidosis, the use of caffeine can actually shift somebody more towards a ketoacidosis or put them at higher risk. You can use urine or blood to monitor the quantity of ketones. The blood tends to be more accurate. The strips are super expensive, like $3 a strip. The ketone strips are dirt cheap, like 10 cents a strip. But again, you're not getting as accurate a measurement. And I believe that you can use both and combine them and use the blood once a day or less as you get adapted to it, and then use the urine to just kind of spot check. It's used in a lot of autoimmune diseases, neurological conditions, and for weight loss. So we'll look at a lot of those benefits and the areas that those are used. They may be acid forming depending on the diet. You can do it in a more alkaline forming way, and I'm going to show you a couple of ways to do that at the end. Some of the ketogenic diets that are making their way into popularity, the carb night diet. It's interesting how people take a concept and then they put their spin on it and they name it something and they write a book. Any of us can do that too. One of these days I am going to do that. The carb night solution, the carb backloading, the MCT oil diet, the Walls protocol, the bulletproof diet, and some of the paleo diets can be considered ketogenic. So the history of ketogenic diet, it was first designed back in 1924. So this is the oldest of these low-carb diets by Dr. Russell Wilder of Mayo, and it was to treat epilepsy. He found that the anti-seizure medications started to come out in 1940s, and then they stopped doing the ketogenic diet research. It's a lot of work. Why not just pop a pill, right? So back then, there were no anti-seizure medications, and he got this brilliant idea by understanding the biochemistry of, like, well, what happens if I put these kids who are seizing or these adults who are seizing on a ketogenic diet? And he got great results. But the research stopped as soon as the pharmaceutical companies came out with the magic bullet, which happens a lot to really sound nutritional research. In 2012, Dominic D'Agostino started the ketonutrition.org. He was a researcher in South Florida, and he published 32 papers on the use of the ketogenic diet with Navy SEALs to fight the hyperbaric oxygen toxicity. And this happens, you know, when you go deep into water and you're diving and you come up too fast, there's a lot of things called the bends. And hyperbaric oxygen toxicity is something that is common, I guess, in the Navy SEALs. So he started studying the ketogenic diet in that use, and that was the more popularizing. So what's going on? Like, what's the science between what's going on in the ketogenic diet and in the body? So the fat is converted in the liver into fatty acids and ketone bodies. The ketones are water soluble. They're not fat soluble. They're water soluble versions of the fat. And the liver makes them when they're metabolizing fat when the carbohydrate intake is low. When you've depleted the stores of glycogen in the liver, it turns to taking the fats coming in, and instead of storing them as fat or utilizing them, it turns them into ketone bodies. And we'll look at the science behind how that happens. But they can be used by energy, but just about every single cell in the body, including the brain. The cells that can't use ketones for energy are red blood cells. So they are acetoacetate, acetone, and beta-hydroxybutyrate. Acetone might sound familiar, as it's nail polish remover. It's in nail polish remover. Okay, body produces this stuff. That doesn't mean you can drink nail polish remover and have it be safe. That doesn't mean if, oh, you want to get up your ketones to drink the acetone. No, it's toxic, but the body produces it. The most common one utilized directly is the beta-hydroxybutyrate. So just to reiterate, ketoacidosis isn't the same as ketosis. Ketoacidosis happens when a person is, their blood is very acidic, and it happens in diabetics. It does not generally happen to the average person going on a ketogenic diet, but it's, again, something that needs to be looked at. A shift towards acidosis, not a dangerous clinical acidosis, but if we're using our pH strips and we're testing somebody's pH and we want it to be, you know, around, you know, 6.8 in the urine, then it starts to get more acidic. That shift is actually a shift in the tissues. The blood is maintaining in still in an alkaline state, the 7.35 to 7.45. But it's when that blood pH shifts to become more acidic, that's when ketoacidosis occurs, and it's extremely dangerous. And it happens in type 1 diabetics when a person doesn't have enough insulin and the ketone levels raise way too high and the blood becomes acidic. So ketosis will lower blood glucose levels. It causes an improvement in insulin resistance. It reduces the occurrence of epileptic seizures. And I just want to mention that there's a keto adaptation period. There's a shift because we're primarily, as we're operating on this standard American diet or a moderate carbohydrate diet, or even most of these low carbohydrate diets, we're really primarily using glucose as fuel. And that shift from using glucose as fuel to using ketones as fuel is an adaptation period. And it takes time, depending on the person and depending on the level of fat and the ratio of carbohydrates in the diet. Some people, what was called keto adapt very quickly. I think I tend to keto adapt very quickly because my blood sugar, if I do a day of fasting, my blood sugar bottoms down to 45 or 50 or 55, and I feel awesome. I feel phenomenal. Why? Because my body's not doesn't care how much sugar's in my blood. It's using ketones, right? Other people take weeks, and some people have to be down to like 5 grams of carbohydrate a day for a couple of weeks before they shift. And I've worked with somebody who that was the case for. It had to be below 10 for her, and it took her 3 weeks to get down there. But I'll share some good news about that later. So, using fat as fuel. It's more efficient to use fat as fuel. You might have heard that no, carbohydrates are what you need to use as fuel, but the body can use either one. When you do carbohydrate metabolism in the mitochondria, the Krebs cycle, you yield 36 ATP molecules from every 6-carbon glucose molecule. With fat metabolism, the fatty acids are generally like the ones that we eat are 18 carbons, 22 carbons. But just to compare it to glucose, the fat metabolism generally will yield about 40 ATP molecules from one six carbon fatty acid molecule. Now, some of them are 22, so they're going to give you more ATP. Some of them are less. The saturated ones give you more than the unsaturated ones. But the point is that it's more efficient. And each fat molecule is going to, or fat six carbon fatty acid molecule is actually going to give you more ATP. So that whole thing is nonsense. Each acetoacetate molecule produces 22 ATP molecules. So as we shift to creating these ketones, the acetoacetate produces 22 ATP molecules. So we have this feeling of being on full better than when we're on a higher carbohydrate diet. So how are ketone bodies metabolized? Well, it occurs mainly in the mitochondria of the liver cells, and they're synthesized from acetyl-CoA. You remember acetyl-CoA from the Krebs cycle? A little diagram over here. We come from glycolysis down to pyruvate, acetyl-CoA, and then that goes into the Krebs cycle. And we've just got a limited picture of the Krebs cycle here. Well, the acetyl-CoA can also be converted to ketone bodies, and ketone bodies can be converted back to acetyl-CoA. It can also be converted in a two-directional fashion to fatty acids, or one-directional to cholesterol. If you remember, at the top of the hormone chart, I definitely have it in the first module where we have the chart of the steroid hormones. You've got cholesterol at the top, which converts down to pregnenolone. But remember, it's acetyl-CoA that is involved in that conversion, and important for hormone synthesis as well. So that's why we may see some improvements in hormones when somebody's on a ketogenic diet. So during prolonged fasting or very low carbohydrate intake, as in a ketogenic diet, the oxaloacetate is depleted. See that oxaloacetate here? That's produced from, it's used in the liver when we do gluconeogenesis. So when you run out of fuel, you go into gluconeogenesis, it depletes the oxaloacetate, which means that the Krebs cycle gets slower, which impedes the entry of the acetyl-CoA into the Krebs cycle. When acetyl-CoA is then converted to ketone bodies, that can produce acetone, acetate, and beta-hydroxybutyrate, which can then go into the beta-oxidation pathway for the fats and then convert into energy into the 40 ATPs instead of 36 ATPs. So it's a pretty cool, it's very complicated science. If you want to sit down and read it, in our textbook, the nutritional medicine, the one that we use for a lot of the different stuff, it's the Advanced Nutrition and Human Metabolism. That's our textbook. They have a really nice chapter on fats, and in that chapter there's about 3 pages that describes in detail, and you can go buggy-eyed, like just trying to follow all the different steps that are happening, but it's the steps of ketone creation, synthesis. So let's look at the mitochondria and the burning of fat. So when the mitochondria burn fat for fuel, it's called beta oxidation. Acetyl-CoA can be converted to ketones. That stabilizes the overexcitation and oxidative stress in the brain. What does that mean? Well, when the brain gets overexcited, we have abnormal firing. What happens in epilepsy, in seizures? The brain is like over-firing. Well, the ketones stabilize that, and it reduces oxidative stress and damage to the brain, right? It also creates epigenetic changes that produce healthy and energetic mitochondria. It helps to protect The mitochondria. These ketone bodies actually protect the mitochondria from oxidative stress, which means the mitochondria can produce more energy. It decreases the overproduction of damaging and inflammatory free radicals. Because what happens in the mitochondria, yeah, we produce energy, but there's a lot of oxidative byproducts that get produced as a result. And guess what? The ketogenic diet, these ketone bodies help to protect the body against that. Very good article that I have referenced there at the bottom of that page. Excellent article if you want to really get into it. So what are some conditions linked to mitochondrial dysfunction from oxidative stress? So if we have this oxidative stress, which we have just by creating it, mitochondria start to decrease if we don't have good oxidative support in the body, right? And mitochondrial dysfunction leads to what? Low energy, right? Right now, I don't feel like I have any mitochondrial dysfunction going on because I feel full and fired. My brain is on fire. I'm very energetic, right? But if my mitochondria were dysfunctioning, I may feel sluggish. I might find it difficult to find my words. I might be kind of shaking my head and trying to figure things out, right? So mitochondrial dysfunction is super important for us to solve, especially in our people who complain about chronic fatigue, that brain fog, that low energy, super, super important. So the kind of things that can be linked to mitochondrial dysfunction: autism, ADD, Parkinson's, depression, anxiety, bipolar, neurodegeneration, that could be Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementias that happen as people are aging. Thinking it's just a natural result of aging. It's not a natural result of aging. It's a natural result of abnormal aging of the brain due to lifestyle and dietary factors. And a ketogenic diet can actually help that. Type 2 diabetes, autoimmune disorders, cancer, all of these things have been linked to mitochondrial dysfunction from the oxidative stress. So wouldn't you want to be helping your clients to protect themselves, their mitochondria, from oxidative damage? You bet. And here's the thing. If you're putting somebody on a ketogenic diet, it doesn't have to be for life. It could be something that they do, and they might do it periodically, similar to what we would do with a cleanse, right? Put somebody on intermittent fasting, which is awesome for creating a ketogenic state. Get them on periodic ketogenic diets. Alternate ketogenic diets with a normal, healthy, moderate carbohydrate diet that continues to keep their blood sugar in balance. Always making sure that we never go high enough on a person's carbohydrate intake that it causes their blood sugars to go out of balance. So I think it's just really a great tool that we can use, not for long-term use. I just don't think that long-term ketogenic diet is necessarily the way to go. There's some downsides to it, but certainly the short-term use of ketogenic diets, and especially the use of ketogenic diets in people with autoimmune diseases, especially autoimmune neurodegenerative diseases like MS, in people with seizures, in people with other autoimmune diseases. So there's a chemical called sirtuins. There's actually 6 different sirtuins so far that have been identified. And there's genes, and these sirtuin genes have a lot to do with mitochondrial protection. We're in the very early stages of research about the sirtuins, but they regulate key functions in the body, like protecting the mitochondria, keeping the telomeres lengthened, right? That's a really important thing. If you don't remember what telomeres are the ends of the DNA. And as we age, as we have exposures, they get chopped off, they get shorter. And when the telomeres get short enough, that cell can't reproduce anymore. The DNA just can't reproduce itself anymore. Telomere lengthening is the subject of a lot of research now. There are some super expensive testing you can do to see what your telomere lengths are, but there's super expensive supplements like $300 a month that you can take to help to lengthen your telomeres. But the good news is that a ketogenic diet can help to lengthen telomeres. That's pretty cool, right? These sirtuins. So these sirtuins have been identified for cell defense, metabolism, etc. The one sirtuin that they found that actually lengthened the lifespan in mice by as much as 15% was SIRT6. Now there's others, and there's a lot of research, and it's still in the early stages, but I think these things are super important. So what we do is we want to include foods that are good SIRT2 foods that contain some of these, like kale and blackberries and green tea and fish oil and olives and onions and chocolate and parsley and turmeric. but also it's positively influenced. These search genes are positively influenced by a diet that's non-glycating. What does that mean? It's a low-carb diet, right? Or a diet that doesn't have that glycation of the red blood cells, of the amino acids, right? Remember glycation. Hemoglobin A1C is glycated red blood cells. Fructosamine, a measurement that can be done in the blood, is glycated amino acids. So a non-glycating diet, meaning a carb-controlled diet, is a good thing. So hemoglobin A1C can actually be a good measure of how well we're doing in terms of this mitochondrial protection. Awesome, right? Let's look at what other things ketones are related to. Ketones have been found to be related to latent viral infections, specifically herpes and the other things that are in that family, like cytomegalovirus and Epstein-Barr virus. And these viral infections, these latent, low-grade, they just hang out there. They do this insidious damage. They contribute to mitochondrial dysfunction. They can drive brain cell loss in neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. So these latent viral infections are linked to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. They can also lead to cancer or other diseases. And guess what? A ketogenic diet can help stabilize the mitochondrial, that's the mtDNA, the mitochondrial DNA, and support that mitochondria back to health and help prevent this. So Alzheimer's has been found over and over again, very good, powerful correlation to be helped by a ketogenic diet. Good stuff. Again, like I said, doesn't mean we want to run out and put everybody on a ketogenic diet, but we want to think about how we can help people to use this therapeutically, even if it's just by doing intermittent fasting to increase ketone bodies, by doing a couple of days a month of a low-carb, super low-carb ketogenic type diet. And we'll look at that. So what are some other benefits of the ketogenic diet? Well, GABA. It actually helps to increase GABA, which calms down the overexcitation of nerves. And that's responsible for a lot of the neurodegenerative diseases. On top of that, you know, GABA people with low GABA have a lot of anxiety, right? So calming them down, ketogenic diet can be really good for anxiety. It increases the mitochondrial NADH, nicotinamide adenosine dinucleotide, with hydrogen appended to it. So it's part of the Krebs cycle. But it's also used in over 450 biochemical reactions, including cell signaling and assisting of DNA repair. So, wow, ketogenic diet helps improve NADH. There's a lot of people now looking at research with using IV NADH to help people with these latent viral infections and with this oxidative damage and stress. It also increases antioxidant pathways, including glutathione. So a ketogenic diet, even a short-term ketogenic diet, can do wonders for improving the antioxidant status in the body, plus anti-inflammatory pathways. And it's super important for helping to clean out the debris, these proteins that are debris that contribute to aging by disrupting the proper functioning of the cells. They call that autophagy, right? So we want the cells to be able to clean up, eat up, gobble up like little Pac-Men to gobble up the protein debris that gets created as a result of our just general metabolic functioning. And ketogenic diet, guess what, helps that. This is a picture. This is very hard to read on the screen. We'll make sure that you have a copy of this. Because of the black background, it's just really hard to read. But it just basically summarizes the data, the research in different areas and where there's very strong evidence that the ketogenic diet helps and then emerging evidence that it helps. And we'll make sure that you get a copy of that that's big enough. I'll look to see if it's big enough on the slides if you were to expand it, but if not, we'll get that to you in a better high quality way. Longevity effects of the ketogenic diet. I want to be doing that now, let alone when I'm her age, right? Calorie restriction causes your body to shift to fat burning metabolism within the mitochondria. We know that. A lot of the longevity studies are looking at calorie restriction, long-term calorie restriction. But guess what? with a ketogenic diet, that fat-burning metabolism is achieved without having to restrict caloric intake, without having to be hungry all the time by doing a ketogenic diet. It's not a high-protein diet, because high-protein diets, unbeknownst to so many people, can actually stimulate insulin. So a lot of these diets that are high-protein, that people are eating animal protein at every meal, like some of the paleo diets, that can actually stimulate insulin, because part of insulin's job is to get the amino acids into the cell. And the amino acids, even in the absence of carb, can be used, can be converted to the glucose, the branch chain ones, the leucine, isoleucine, and glycine. So it promotes the codification of genes, the coding for specific genes that make the mitochondria and the hippocampus work better and makes more energy available. What's the hippocampus? That's the seat of memory. Important memory. So it actually, by doing a ketogenic diet, you can improve the health of the hippocampus. You can improve its resilience to stress. And some studies have shown by as much as 60%. So this is huge. Memory improves. Improves viral loads. It improves the mitochondrial metabolism and oxidative stress and inflammation. The excitability of the brain in terms of things like seizures, and also ADD. Lots of great stuff. So what's keto adaptation? Well, if somebody moves too quickly from their diet, which is maybe a typical high-carb diet, into a low-carb diet, there's a period of keto adaptation where the body is trying to figure out this whole process of using fat instead of glucose. And you can feel awful. They call it the keto flu, right? And the symptoms are pretty uncomfortable as the body switches away. It could take weeks or months in ketosis to adapt. And usually that's because somebody jumps into it. I think that when you transition somebody, like, for example, you take somebody through our sweet spot diet, and you get them through there, and you get them to gradually do that, and then going to keto diet for a short period of time would be much easier. But we even find that keto adaptation happening in a lot of people who go from, you know, a standard diet to our sweet spot diet, which is not super low carb, but it's low carb, as low as carb as people need to. And for some people, it is super low carb. So we have people transition slowly to avoid this. But yeah, I find that for most people, 2 to 3 weeks, if they go into it pretty quickly, they can have those achy, headachy, insomnia, constipation, fatigue. And it all depends on how the body is working. If somebody comes into it and they have great thyroid function, great liver function, the adrenals are great, and their kidney's fine, it's not going to be a problem. But if somebody has impaired thyroid function, or their liver is sluggish, or their adrenals are dysfunctioning, hyper or hypo, or the kidneys aren't working well, then this keto adaptation period is going to be longer. And if you find somebody really uncomfortable in this, I would advise that you just move it slowly and just gradually taper them. So how do you figure out if a person's in a state of ketosis? Well, you look at their carbs, their state of carbs, first of all. For some people, just getting under 100 grams works. For others, under 50 grams, and for a lot under 10 grams. And it just depends on the person and their metabolism and a lot of other things. You can also look at the macronutrient ratios. There's a lot of conflicting information about that. You know, should it be 80% fat? Should it be lower? But you want to measure, right? So keep the carbs in the range. So start with the under 100, just so that you're not making them go into crazy keto adaptation too quickly. And you test. You get the urine strips, you get the blood strips, and you test it. I like to use a combination where you can kind of see how the strips, the urine strips, are working in comparison to the blood, so see if it's close. Because the blood strips are expensive. They're about $250 to $3 per strip. I have one of those units and I haven't tested it yet. I plan to. So you want to measure, you want to keep the carbs within the range, and you're just going to modify and help them to tweak. So what's the advantage? We talked about a lot of advantages: controlling blood sugar, improving memory, mental clarity, reducing seizures, can help with chronic IBS and gut inflammation. It can help with improving mitochondrial function or mitochondrial function, decreasing insulin, and it's a preferred fuel for the brain. They burn cleaner in the brain when you can get somebody getting their brain burning ketones. Some of the downsides of a ketogenic diet: it can be acid forming, especially if somebody's using caffeine and too many animal products and too much protein. It's very restrictive, so you get people to try to do it is really hard. They're used to having their carbs and they want to eat the way they want to eat. So it's more restrictive than a lot of the other diets. The high fat can be hard on the liver. I've had people going through this. She does amazing on a ketogenic diet and it helps her with her brain function, her memory, her speech, and her functioning, her limb functioning in MS-like symptoms. But when she does it for longer than a month or month and a half at a time, she starts to get a severe pain in her liver and she has to back off. So we're working on how do we do the up and down, phasing in, phasing out approach to her so she gets the benefits. And then once she goes back off the ketogenic diet, very quickly her brain function goes down. It's really challenging for some folks. There are certain foods that are included on a ketogenic diet that could be problematic for some people. Bone broths, fermented foods, because they're high in amines if people have histamine issues. And they're also high in FODMAPs for people who have irritable bowel and are sensitive to FODMAPs. They also contain glycine, which can convert to oxalates. So if you have anybody that's got FODMAP sensitivity, oxalate sensitivity, or histamine, you got to go slowly and just stay away from these bone broth kind of concoctions that are used a lot in ketogenic diets. You want to be careful and not do it with people who have compromised kidney function, extreme adrenal fatigue, poor thyroid function, and poor electrolyte imbalance. Now, if you've got somebody who's on medication for hypothyroidism or they have Hashimoto's, I'd go careful. I wouldn't necessarily not do it, but I'd just progress carefully and make sure that it doesn't aggravate that situation. Because we don't see a lot of people who have perfect thyroid function, do we? Right? So it's just a matter of going slowly and keeping things in mind. And you're certainly not going to do it in a pregnant or nursing woman. So let's look at some modifications of the keto diet. My friend Dr. Anna Kabeka created a program. She calls it the Keto Alkaline Diet. And what she basically does is have people test their urine for both ketones and their pH, because inevitably on a ketogenic diet, most people get very acidic in their pH in their urine. And she modifies the amount of ketones the amount of fat. And she also uses a lot of the green stuff. She uses her Mighty Maca powder and other things. So this is a protein powder she created, and it's 28 grams of protein in it. So for people who don't want to eat a lot of meat on a ketogenic diet, this protein powder does the trick. It provides plenty of protein. So they can eat a lot of veggies, they can eat that, and they can eat small amounts of meat and keep their liver from going nutty. Terry Wall, she had MS. There she is with her wheelchair, and she gave it up after a year on her diet. She got frustrated. She was a medical doctor. She went through the medical system. She was frustrated by not getting results, and she just started playing with the diet, and she played around with a straight paleo and keto diet, and what she came up with is a modification of it. And there's a lot of vegetables right at the base. She's got a lot of the low-carb base vegetables and fruits there with smaller amounts of meat than a typical ketogenic diet. And she includes other things to help support it, right? So really, really much improved. And this is what helped her to get over her MS. So it's a matter of figuring out for each person, what's that modification that's going to work for them. And for me, my ketogenic diet modifications, I have my sweet spot diet, which is a low carb diet, but it's based on how low is based on how the person's reacting and what their blood sugar is looking like. So it's lots and lots of starchy, non-starchy vegetables, as many as your body can tolerate without raising the blood sugar up. Protein powders, fermented foods, coconut and MCT oils, moderate amounts of germinated nuts and seeds, and test blood sugar and ketones. So it's based on, but it's taking it a step further. For some people, that sweet spot diet does give them the effects of a ketogenic or mild ketogenic. We are starting to shift into ketone burning, but to go further is where you're adding, you know, the coconut, and more coconut, MCT oil, and that's basically what I've done. I've put together a plant-powered version because the person that wanted to do this was like very, very strict vegan. She wouldn't even consider taking a lanolin-based D3. So she wanted to do this ketogenic, but she wanted to do it in a way that was not going to compromise her ideals. And she had phenomenal, phenomenal results, except after a while, the fat got to her liver. So we're still working with her and balancing her. So that's my version of it. It's, you know, it's something I play with and individualize between each person. The other thing that's relatively new, I mean, these exogenous ketones have been around a while, but most of them have been very poor quality products loaded with caffeine and other things that I didn't appreciate. This one is a plant-based. There's no animal products in it. It's basically, it's beta-hydroxybutyrate. It's free of caffeine, and it allows you to take in exogenously, externally, the beta-hydroxybutyrate ketone body and not have to do such a high-fat diet. So the person I was just telling you about, we're about to start, she tried it a couple of times. She didn't have enough to make it through the 2 month trial she wants to do. She just ordered more. She's going to do a trial with it. But what happened when she first took it is she went into ketosis within an hour. She does the blood strip. So she measured it and she was shocked because she said normally when she's shifting from going from her off time on the keto to on times, it takes like minimum 3 days of really serious, like almost fasting to get there, and sometimes a week or two if it's just a severe low carb. So she got there in 60 minutes and it maintained all the way through till bedtime that night. So you can use it as part of a cleanse with this powder. You can actually take it with some protein powders and some green powders, and you can actually design a cleanse for someone where you can help them to get into this ketosis without having to go severe low fat. The jury's out. I haven't done it. I just ordered myself some. I'm going to be trying it and we'll be posting to see how that goes. They recommend that you take the ketones about 45 minutes before a workout and include it with some MCT oil. Not a lot, just 25 calories. And I've given you some links where they have their different kinds of diets. Again, you take it with a grain of salt and you do it in the way that works for you and for your client. And like anything else that we do with people, it's a matter of trial and error. Try this. Oh, that worked well, but this didn't work with it. Let's shift that around. And when you understand the science behind it, you are better able to make decisions and help people to modify and support themselves. So thank you for listening. I want to show you, I have a whole bunch of references. These are some more general references on the different diets. These are 2 pages of ketogenic diet references. They're all there for you to look at and study if that's what you want to do. And thank you so much for listening.